It's time now for the Todd Leonard Show. Leave those negative stories behind as we focus on the positive and hear from those who give back and help others. Let's start your day with some inspirational stories. Now, here's your host, Todd Leonard.
Good morning, everyone. Hope you're having a great weekend. We've had some incredible weather here in New Jersey. And I want to say I'm so excited to have a hero on today, Dr. Satari, right here in Essex County, is going to be joining us. Doctor, with us this morning?
Good morning.
Good morning, Doctor. Thank you so much for waking up and tuning in with us today. We're really happy you joined us. So, Doc, I ask everyone, you know, we're in the middle of COVID-19. It looks like we're starting to finally turn the corner, but I know we still have a lot of work in front of us. So how are you and your family holding up during the COVID-19 pandemic?
We're doing great as far as, you know, looking at the whole entire situation. Like you said, there's a sign of slowing down, which is great. But as we said, it's not over yet.
No, it's not over, but I can tell driving around recently, it seems like a lot of people have been going stir crazy and they just want to get out of the house and start kind of living a little bit more as it was pre-COVID, and we all realize we still have to social distance, but it's certainly very encouraging. So, Doc, you know, every weekend when I have a great honor bringing people on, I always like to learn a little bit about the backstory. I don't want you to feel like this is a deposition or anything. I just want to get a little background so all the listeners can know a little more about. Gotcha. So I know you're a doctor. Where are you from originally, Doc?
I was born in Iran. You know, I lived there for 18 years, and because of some political situation, I moved to Europe. I was able to continue my career in medicine. I went to medical school over there, and came to U.S. for some research after end of my medical school. I was planning to continue a career in surgery, but somehow I end up in anesthesiology.
Yeah, so, Doc, let me ask you. So I've never met anyone from Iran, at least certainly not on the show. What was it like growing up in Iran?
We have a lot of things happening, life was not bad. I mean, it was a very civilized, industrial country in the beginning, and very educated people with good education. But unfortunately, it turned, to a different way, it became more difficult to live. Correct.
Right. So you mentioned you're a doctor. So I always ask people, what's the driving force behind your career, and how do you end up, you know, becoming a doctor? I think it's a great profession. I mean, God bless the heroes right now. I mean, finally, the doctors, the nurses, the healthcare workers are getting their just due, because this is like every day of your life. When you're in medicine, you're really helping and making people, God willing, better. Why medicine? Why become a doctor?
It's multifactorial. Since I remember, I was a kid, I always like try to rescue animals with broken legs or whatever to save them. I always have some pets at home that I try to, when I find them out there, like, that stay. And also, you know, I always was interested in that field. When I was in medical school in Belgium, I went through different pandemic. It was the HIV pandemic. It was, actually we're taking care of some soldiers that were coming, that they were, exposed to mustard gas. I always had that on me, like to be part of that field.
Right. Did you have family, back in Iran and, you know, obviously in Europe, that were in the medical field, or were you the first one to embark on a medical career?
I was the first one. We came mostly from an engineer family, but we have like a lot of doctors in my family. My two sisters are And I have a few people here in this country also.
Oh, wonderful. So what type of medicine do you practice, Doc?
Right now I'm an anesthesiologist.
Right.
In Livingston. And, you know, that's my practice. I'm doing that for more than 20 years.
Oh, so you've been an anesthesiologist for over 20 years?
Yes.
Right. And but why anesthesiology? I mean, there's so many different areas of medicine. Was there something about that field that you gravitated to?
It was a long process. You know, you never know as a medical student what you want exactly to do because everything is so interesting. And in the beginning, I was looking toward a field in surgical. And the anesthesiology actually is a combination of a lot of fields in medicine. There's critical care, there's physiology, there's pharmacology. It's very hands-on, and it's very gratifying because we see immediate results. You know, we're able to save, to help patients very quickly, very fast, make a difference, make them through the surgery, remove the pain. It's a very active field of medicine. It's very fast-paced. We need a very good reaction time to emergencies. It's not a regular field of medicine that you see patient in the office and, you know, patient come and visit you over and over again. We see one patient and we usually go to the next one. But we make a big difference at the time we see them.
Right. So in terms of anesthesiology, now, do you practice at a local hospital here in New Jersey?
Yes.
Right.
In Livingston, New Jersey.
Yeah, right. In Essex County?
Yes.
Right. So in terms of your career trajectory, did you have anything that happened in your life where you had your own, you know, medical crisis in terms of kind of just a little bit of your journey in life?
Yes. I mean, I personally was unfortunate to have a major medical problem like 15 years ago. I was out of work close to a year. I had like 3 surgeries. I was myself a patient, so I know what a patient feels on the other side of our field, and to be desperate or lose hope.
Right. What was that like, though? I mean, was that must have been a crazy, challenging time to be out of work a year and to be so sick for, you know, quite a period of time.
Yes, it was not pleasant. But, you know, people make a difference. When I was back myself as a patient in ICU, I don't remember too much of the few months I was there, but I always remember that nurse who came with her CD player back then and was playing classical music. And when I was hearing, I remember that classical music that she was playing. And I still remember that, so I think that's helped me a lot.
So the music, and even though you were so sick,
yeah.
The nurse, and, you know, we had a nurse on not that long ago, Amy Pierce, and, you know, my late dad always called nurses angels, and, you know, as a younger person, I'm like, angels? And then as you get older, you really appreciate what the nurses and certainly the doctors do. Do you think that experience, you know, changed your life in terms of, you know, your medical career and your gratitude to God and everything that you were able to ultimately achieve?
Absolutely. It gave me a different perspective in life. You know, we go through life very fast. We take everything for granted. And, you know, at that time, my son was 6 months old, so I was like hoping to see him again. And, it gave a different perspective. And I know this COVID situation also changed a lot of people because, you know, it's a little cells with no brain and a branch of protein can destroy the entire human dynamic. So we can learn a lot from this.
Right. So, we were talking, I asked you how you're doing, you know, in COVID-19, and thankfully you're doing quite well. Have you ever been through a quarantine before, Doc, in your life?
This is something I talk to my son about. I mean, this is maybe my third one.
Third? Whoa.
Yeah.
Third. My God, I'm ready. You know, I'll tell you, everybody's ready to jump out a window, but I think we're starting to loosen up a little bit. But
yeah,
wow, three. That seemed pretty good. I have to ask you, I mean, so what's that? I mean, happened?
I was the first one, you know, I was like, I think 15. Then it was a war period. I was 18. And, it was not easy. And back then there was no Netflix, there was no internet, there was nothing. So, can you imagine keep yourself busy, as a teenager boy? But,
how long was that quarantine for?
It was, each of them was more than 6-7 months.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know you kind of joke, but I know it was that serious. But I mean, obviously nowadays, I mean, people at least are on Netflix or whatever the heck they're doing to entertain themselves. So 6 or 7 months, was it like a total like lockdown for like it was here for a while, or was it, a little bit looser?
It was basically like not safe to go out for many reasons. I mean, the life stopped, the work stopped, there was like essential business working, and the economy stopped. It was a war type of quarantine. It was not a disease.
Right, so basically everybody's life was in jeopardy, so that must have been quite an experience. When you were able to get through that, like 6 or 7 months, I mean, were people just, you know, going crazy, so happy to be, you know, be able to leave their home, or was it still like a war-torn environment and it was still very dangerous?
No, it was, you know, if you want to compare to the COVID situation, it was maybe the same, because even that right now people go out, this virus is not going away. So it's a new normal, new adjustment, and people have to basically take precaution. Same as what I went through before and same as now.
No, yeah, of course. So that was the first, quarantine. And, like, you're a fascinating guest because to think you've been through this three times now. What was the second time, Doc, Dr. Sitari, that you went through a quarantine?
It was, my country was in a wartime. If you know the political history a little bit in the 80s, there was a big war going on with Iraq, our neighbor, and... it was a time that there was a bomb in the city every night, and we were staying at home in our basement or a safe area, and not too much exposure outside during the day, just for essential businesses, shopping, etc. But I know the school were closed, everything was closed.
How long did that one last?
That was a long period of war, but I left after a few years. I went to Europe.
Right. But once again, I mean, you went through a lot of adversity. So when this pandemic hit us, I'm always fascinated by it because I try to, you know, be as up to date on what's going on in the world. And I was, candidly, it snuck up on me. I mean, I heard a little something was going on in China and Wuhan, I guess December-ish, January. I guess like a lot of Americans, I'm like, well, you know, we're United States and we're going to be fine. And then all of a sudden March, just, you know, we're talking about March madness. When did you realize, you know, COVID-19? Because you're a medical professional, so I'm a trial lawyer. So to me, I mean, I'm not saving lives. It's basically, you know, you're dealing with, you know, the reality of, well, we're going to rely on the healthcare workers. God bless them. But when did you know, as a medical professional in the healthcare industry, that something was going on with this virus?
We basically find out with everybody else back in December and January that what's happening in China. And I was personally following that closely because it was happening in Europe before here, and I have family member in Europe, I have my parents and my sisters. So they were dealing with that like 2-3 weeks before us. And it was a period of confusion because, you know, somehow we always think that because of that big ocean between us and everybody else, we are kind of untouchable. But that didn't happen. And when we had the first case, early March, I think, back in, it was Seattle, if I remember, and we had the first case a week after that in New York, I realized that it's coming here. But we really didn't feel the gravity of the situation till end of March.
Right, so here's my I'm obviously very interested. I think the listeners hopefully are also. In terms of, and if you can just talk up just a little bit if it's possible, because
sure.
I'm on this Facebook Live. It's exciting for me and the listeners to, hear you as I'm doing the interview. Just if you just keep your voice up a little bit. So
sure.
In terms of the hospital setting, were you, as a healthcare provider at a local hospital, was your team getting geared up? Were you trying to educate yourself like all of us as quick as possible?
Yes, we had actually started a communication between all of us with the latest references about this disease to get ready for it and see how we can manage it when we hit us. But everything happened very fast. Happened over like a week or 2 weeks' time. We saw a surge of patients coming in, and we changed our practice to help the patients. We set up an intubation team to be able to intubate all these patients for the ventilators. But after a week of time, I mean, our entire practice become almost 90% to take care of the corona patients.
Right. So, Doc, I had a question about that. So are we talking approximately like mid-March when you saw like basically all of a sudden it just like took over everything, every medical facility? I mean, sadly, New Jersey, I think there's close to 10,000 poor souls that lost their lives, and it's really impacted us in a tremendous way. Was it around that mid-March area where you just realized, like this is like we're in the middle of a pandemic?
Yeah, mid-March we realized we were in the middle of pandemic. When I think they closed the school, I think it was March 19. Then somehow the feeling changed, and a week later, yes, the hospital were totally exposed.
So what is that like? So this is a virus that obviously we weren't alive in the Spanish flu in 1918, but and obviously you're a smart man, you're a physician for many years now, but what was it like when you were all of a sudden in the middle of COVID-19 and you and your colleagues are scrambling and you're doing all these intubations and, that basically took over the medical, really the world here, certainly in New Jersey. What is that like? What did that feel like emotionally, physically?
I mean, there was a big confusion in the beginning, because of the unknown factor. We didn't know too much about this virus, and we just know it was deadly, and it was a big decision making for all of us, because right away our practice changed, and so it was a lot of personal decision, emotional decision, and so it was a hard week to adjust. A lot of us jump into the field and start practice and participating in all the different fields, getting ready. Some of us needed a little more time to get ready emotionally, mentally, but in general, everybody as a team, we all came together. We're a big group with all our differences, but at the end, we all work together.
Right. So, I mean, it's togetherness. There's no question about it. So, were you like just reading up as much as you can? I mean, you're obviously, you know, you're trying to save lives and everybody's kind of learning as you go. But what is that like? Just, you know, you're making life and death decisions. I mean, you're on the anesthesiology end of it, but, you know, my understanding would be you'd be involved, you know, with the intubation of patients when it's appropriate to bring your specialty in. But what is that like? I mean, you're all kind of learning as you go. Had you ever been in that before in your career?
Not at this level, because, like I told you, there was a pandemic of HIV, but it was much more controlled. This is a much more deadly and more aggressive type of virus. And also there was a lot of unknown, and what we were seeing on the patient was nothing like before. Like, we were seeing blood works or medical condition that we never seen before or never described in any other textbook. So it was a big learning experience for the first week.
Right. So I had a question about that, Doc. So I understand, you know, in medical field, medical conditions, people present with a certain set of symptoms or signs, or you do your differential diagnosis. You go through a litany of diagnostics trying to figure out what people have. With the COVID-19 patients, when you started to see them in, let's say, middle part of March, were they presenting in a certain way in terms of just like a signature of the disease? Were they presenting differently? Was there some like classic signs looking back, like, yeah, that's exactly how they were presenting?
Yes and no, because a lot of our patients, they were exposed to that virus and they never experienced any major symptoms or never came to the hospital. But what we saw right away, that if you end up in the hospital at the stage that you have to come to the hospital, then the situation was bad. And the sign that we were seeing was very acute exacerbation of disease process and low oxygen in the blood and the difficulty of the patient for gasping for air.
So you basically have oxygen deprivation. Was there like a signature in the diagnostics, either the lung scans or other diagnostic tools? Or is it just you took their oxygen saturation levels, they were really low in the 40s instead of in the high 90s? How did you understand, you know, like that presentation at that point?
Yeah, in the beginning we thought it was respiratory issues, mostly like pneumonia. But as the time passed, quickly we understood that this was a more in-depth problem with the blood coagulation and major inflammation. So when we understand that it was not just a pneumonia like influenza, we start having better results on our patients.
Right. I mean, you're obviously learning as quick as you possibly can. So one of the things that, I'll be honest, I never heard of PPE before until this pandemic struck. I mean, I never really thought about it, to be honest. I mean, I realize, you know, you're in the hospital setting, you have the doctors, the nurses, they might have a mask on, gloves perhaps. What was that like in the initial stages with, you know, PPE and just how the whole healthcare community were coming to grips with that issue?
I mean, we had some PPE in the past, but we were not using regularly on everybody. We have some infectious disease type of procedures that we were using those masks and PPE before, but when it became as a pandemic and we had to use that on a regular basis, obviously there was a big shortage the first week. But fortunately, I mean, our hospital did an amazing job to provide us with all the, PPE and mask and shields that we needed. So I never felt, at least where I worked, that there was a shortage, and that helped us a lot with practicing our duty.
Right, absolutely. The other thing that I never put any thought to be honest, probably like most of us, is ventilators. I mean, who would think about a ventilator, to be honest, until this pandemic struck? What was that like at you work at an incredible local facility with a tremendous reputation. Were there ventilator issues, or thankfully also you had the adequate equipment when necessary?
We have a sensors that goes out every night at 5 p.m. And there were a few days that when I was looking at the sensors and there was no ventilator left, or a very few left. But again, fortunately, we never had to deal with deciding if we have to put a patient on ventilator or not at our hospital.
Well, that's very fortunate. I mean, what was your reaction? You know, obviously your facility, you know, really one of the finest in the state, and we're very fortunate. I mean, Morris County has some incredible facilities as well. But were you also following what was going on nationwide in terms of some potential shortages and just, you know, because you're in the medical end of it. I'm a layman. I try to be educated as much as possible, like probably most of the listeners. But were you also studying what was going on in other facilities?
Yes and no. I was, you know, we were so busy where we were at that actually we put all my effort and energy into what we were doing in our hospital. But, of course, I was watching the news, what happened in New York, that they had a much worse than us, and a few other hospitals in New Jersey that I have some friends working, that they were also, you know, the frontliner for this disease, like a big hospital in Jersey. But yes, I was following like everybody else, but not specifically more in detail.
Right. Well, it sounds like you certainly had your hands full. So what was that like? I mean, you're in the middle of it. I mean, it's a crisis. Was it just like nonstop? I mean, you know, I mean, obviously thankfully the curve is flattening and we're seeing some light at the end of the tunnel, which is certainly a blessing to say the least. But what was that like? I mean, you work all day and, you're in the battle, really. It's a war. And you come home. I mean, what's that feeling like physically, emotional? And what's that like?
We were a big anesthesia group, so we were able to staff it very adequately, very fast. So the hours were very manageable, but when we were there, it was emotionally and physically very tiring, obviously. And, you know, basically after our shift, it was a whole routine, you know, to clean up, take showers, multiple showers during work time. And there's a whole process of coming in the house, leaving your clothes outside, and taking a shower, then cleaning your clothes. And so it was a routine that we all did, like after each shift.
Well, that's once again. I mean, there's just incredible what the healthcare workers have been doing for the last number of months, really. Through their entire career, but we have a spotlight on it. Doc, we're going to take a very short break and be back in 30 seconds.
The Todd Leonard Show is sponsored by the Leonard Foundation, whose mission is to support the children and families who are battling pediatric cancer and those in need of food and assistance, women's shelters, and other important social services in the community. They also proudly support those fighting pancreatic cancer. They feel it's vitally important to help those in need in our amazing community when they need us the most. Please join them in extending a helping hand and go to leonardcharity.org and donate now. Together, we can touch many lives.
So, Doctor, once again, I mean, this is incredible to have you on this morning. So we're with Dr. Sitari. So, Doc, you touched on something that, you know, I got to bring home the point. You know, let's say I went out shopping. You as just a layman, I mean, you put your gloves on, your mask on. You go to the supermarket. You do your thing. You come home. And, you know, God willing, you didn't contract anything. But what's it like as a medical provider in the trenches? I mean, saving lives, and then you got to come home, and then you've got to basically go through this whole routine. What's that like psychologically in terms of any fears, anxiety of, did I contract it? You know, am I doing the right thing? You know, I don't want to get my loved ones ill, my friends. So what is that like coming home after a shift?
I'm going to backtrack a little bit to like early March and February, if you don't mind.
Please.
Unfortunately, I have a lot of colleagues, not specifically in my field, but some other field that they end up very sick, and they were exposed to the virus early March. And we as an anesthesia team, I mean, we are lucky. I didn't have anybody in my department who were severely sick. We have a few that were exposed, but nobody got like severely ill. I think in early March, when there was another awareness, I think that was the most dangerous part or the time, because we were not taking precautions since we didn't know the virus was here. And once the situation changed and we were exposed, there was this fear that everybody had. Are we doing the right thing? Are we covered? Are we doing everything we can? There's anything we can do more? So there was this fear for all of us for a few weeks of, are we getting exposed or not? You know, I personally didn't see my son for like a good month. I have a few colleagues that as well, they quarantine themselves in the basement. They have all the parents at home, or a couple of us, they slept in a hotel room for a few weeks. But as the time passed, we realized that knowing the danger and getting ready actually sometimes is safer than going to a supermarket, if that makes sense, because we know the situation, we get ready for it, and then we have a whole routine how to clean up. And at this time, actually, you know, all of us, most of us got tested multiple times, and like I said, there's only a handful that got exposed to the virus, and actually they did very well. I also, you know, I have a background in wellness practice. I help a lot of my colleagues with supplementation. Our immune system is so important to fight this disease. And what we saw on most of our patients, unfortunately, is the one who had a not so adequate lifestyle, obesity, diabetes, high blood pressure, they do much worse. So if anything the listener can take out from this this talk today is to promote their well-being, nutrition, exercise, whole food is so important to fight the disease, because this virus will be here for a long time. It's not going to go away. It's like an influenza virus. It's always here. And we need to find a way for our body to fight that. And what I saw is healthy lifestyle, boosting your immune system, and trying to not become diabetic, hypertensive, which is all disease of the lifestyle that we have, can enormously help to stay healthy.
Right. So, Doc, I had some follow-ups with that, and thank you for sharing that for us. In terms of the presentation of the patients, you know, initially everybody at least was reading or trying to figure out who was going to perhaps unfortunately fall victim to it. And the way it was initially discussed was it was going to be the elderly population. Was that how it presented at this hospital you've been working at for all this time? Was it just the elderly, or was it more of a cross-section demographically?
No, I don't agree as much with that. I mean, we have a, you know, of course, the elderly population are always at higher risk, but I have to say that I saw a lot of patients in the mid-50s, early 60s, but all of them with the same problem, overweight and diabetes.
So you saw a lot of like pre-existing comorbidities, because I understand diabetes, hypertension was certainly something. So doc, you know, one of the things that I did see, which has been really a beautiful, uplifting part of this very challenging time for all of us, because we're all in this together, is the community outreach. The folks that have been giving back. I mean, I was joking with my friends about, you know, you guys get a lot of pizza, which is wonderful. It's very thoughtful. And in terms of just, you know, the community support, you know, the parades and all the wonderful things that are going on, the donations of, you know, and 95 masks and all the other attendant things that people are trying to do to show their love and support, the signs. What is that like for you and your team, the hospital staff, when you see that kind of community support?
It was amazing. It was amazing because, you know, somehow as a healthcare worker, we kind of feel that we are not appreciated a lot of times in a normal situation. This show us a lot. This show us that people are very supportive. Our hospital walls are full of drawing by the kids, supporting everybody, supporting the nurses, the anesthesiologists, the doctors, the cleaning people, I mean, everybody who works in the hospital. We receive donations for PPEs. I have neighbors that call me and they donate face shields, masks. I have personal friends that are in construction business. They gave me N95 masks in the beginning. Some people in our hospital, they start a Facebook, COVID hero, donation, and so many people donate through that site. And we receive lunches and dinners, and which is what's so helpful before, because we never had time to go to the cafeteria, to get any food, and so that was super helpful. I have personally, I have friends that they call me, they text me, they stop by, they give me stuff. My restaurants in town, my favorite restaurants that I know the owner, they basically forced me to go pick up food from them. Yeah, there was a lot of support, and we really, really appreciate it.
Right. So, I mean, I bring up the signs every time I drive around town. I see all these wonderful signs, you know, God bless the healthcare heroes. I run a little something in the Daily Record. If there's an ad running today on the front page, just, you know, God bless the first responders and the healthcare workers. They are heroes. You are heroes. I mean, what's more important than putting your life on the line to help other people and save lives? So, Doc, you know, we're in an interesting time right now in terms of telemedicine, in terms of just how people are kind of living their lives now. What's your thoughts? I mean, I don't know if you had a chance yet to reflect on it, but how telemedicine is kind of getting involved in really how patients are having their healthcare delivered to them.
I think it's the future. I personally had a few consultations with my doctors during this time, you know, there's always a place to go to the office and see your doctor one-to-one, but I think it will be the future because a lot of trip to our doctor is not always necessary. And it's not only the telemedicine, but I think it will be a big change in every aspect of our life in many different profession, and it will be a new way of doing businesses.
Yeah, I mean, I know in my law firm, I mean, candidly, my team is working remotely unless there's some urgent matter. Somebody else might come in for a little while, but in essence, I mean, that just seems to me like going to be the wave of the future. Court appearances, we're doing, you know, virtual arbitrations, no trials right now, unless you want to have a virtual trial. But I mean, depositions, everybody's now doing them through remote technology. So I certainly see a wave of the future, and I see a lot more efficiency by it. In terms of even now, at your local facility, are they using a little bit of telemedicine to interface with professionals like yourself? Are you starting to see that take place?
I mean, are you relating to the COVID situation?
The COVID situation.
I mean, this is a totally hands-on practice right now. So if you're talking about the patient in the hospital, I mean, telemedicine doesn't apply. I mean, it's a hands-on work.
Right, but let's say, for example, someone needs a, like, let's say you have a specialist in the facility and they need to speak to another expert in the field. Can they at least now do, you know, a video meeting to talk about how that patient's presenting? Is any of that going on yet in the facility?
Absolutely. That was going on for a long time when we were requesting any more help or information from other colleagues. Yeah, we were always having that. But we're talking about the patient-doctor relationship. I think in the future, the telemedicine will be a new way.
Right, of course. No, I understand that distinction. In terms of, you know, when you're in the room with a patient, and one of the things, the real tragic thing about COVID-19 is the family members can't physically be there because of the threat of the disease spreading. Now, what is that like, Doc, when you're in that situation, you're with the patient, but their loved ones aren't there? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, it's very hard for the family, very hard. And I have a personal experience with that. And we have a patient that I, as a group, we took care of him for a week. You know, I was involved with that patient for like a good 2 weeks on my shift, but with other people helping me as well. And he had a family member in London, his sister. And we were able to take the patient off the ventilator on a Saturday that I was working and I was doing my shift. And I know the sister were calling like every day and talking to nurses, to the doctors, the staff. So when I was able to take the patient off the respirator, I FaceTimed the sister in London, and the reaction of the patient's face was such that almost everybody in the room started crying.
Right, so that's an uplifting situation. You're there, you're getting to know the patient. I mean, you're caring for that person, putting everything you have, your expertise for 2 weeks, and you're able to have that loved one interact with another loved one, ironically, in London, even outside the United States of America. And you talked about the emotion. I love hearing stories like that. I mean, you know, that's uplifting. I mean, certainly to have such a great outcome. And how fulfilling is that? How did that make you and the team feel, you know, in terms of just being able to be there and make a real positive difference in their trajectory in life?
It's a mixed feeling. It's happiness, it's sadness, it's sometimes hopeless because we cannot help more. It's a very mixed feeling. But overall, it was positive. It was positive to see that somebody did better. Somebody was able to be extubated. It was positive to see the family member happy, and yeah, it's all this little part adds on to the emotional part of it to make us going.
Right, so that was something that, you know, I'm not there like you, and God bless everyone that's doing it. What is that feeling when you have a patient, you're able to extubate, and they're going to be able to leave the facility, let's say? I was watching, you know, it's emotional, even just for me, watching, you know, the healthcare workers line up in the hallway, and they wheel out the patient, and there's like a standing ovation. What is that like for your team?
I mean, we have like a chat group between all of us that every time somebody was extubated, we were like saying something, that one more or a second one, or, you know, and we were all cheering with thumbs up, happy face. So it was boosting our morale. And, you know, the hospital play also type of music every time somebody gets discharged. When we have our 100 patients discharged, there's a huge celebration at the front lobby. It helps a lot with everyday work. It helps us to go back and do what we have to do.
Right. I mean, that's got to be an incredible feeling. I had Amy Pierce on a few weeks ago, worked out of Newton, and St. Clair's in Dover, and she was talking, they played a Beatles song whenever a patient, you know, was getting discharged. And I was like, yeah, I mean, you got to grasp onto hope and feel that you're making a difference, you know, a positive difference. What's it like when you come home, though? Do you have, like, how do you decompress from that? Because it's got to be like a pressure cooker. Are there things that you do and your colleagues do just to kind of like decompress from just being in that stressful environment?
I personally exercise. That was my way to decompress, go for a walk, do something online, on YouTube, or something that's coming out from my gym that is closed. I try to sleep and rest a lot, which was I was able to do to recover. I also took advantage of the empty shores or Jersey Shore during this period. It was amazing. Some great days with some sun. There was nobody on the ocean, on the beaches, and the ocean were beautiful. You know, and again, thank God we have Netflix, Amazon Prime. So that was it. There was not too much else we can do. It was mostly decompress, rest, put our energy back together and go back.
So you touched on something a little bit earlier about some of the comorbidities, diabetes, hypertension. You're also an expert in wellness. What do you think about telemedicine and the way that, you know, patients can interact with doctors remotely just to kind of monitor how they're doing with making sure they're keeping diseases down? Do you think that has some potential for growth in the future?
Yeah, this is a field of medicine that's growing very fastly. When I started this wellness practice like 14 years ago, it was not a norm. But fortunately now, you know, the stores, the media are more into preventive medicine and staying away from bad habits. As I say, you know, exercise and nutrition is like 80% of the entire process. You correct those, a lot of bad diseases that we have as a human population because of our habits will go away. And we see with COVID, I mean, it's very simple. Obesity and diabetic, it's all related to food and lifestyle. And people that don't have that, they may get the virus, but they don't go to the degree of the disease that we see. Obviously, there is some exception, and we have seen many healthy people that are not doing well. But when you look at the overall, it's the being healthy and increasing your immune system. And if we can promote the telemedicine, and there is app that we can track with the doctor your evolution when you start the process. If it can help with the patient to stay healthy, why not?
Right, absolutely. That's what I was trying to, you know, like, delve in with you, is your experience with the wellness field, with what you're seeing with COVID-19. We all now know, like, telemedicine is becoming so much more popular, and it's almost like everybody's getting an epiphany. It's like, this is a wonderful idea. We got to stay with this. And then I wanted to bring it back home with your experience with treating people with these premorbidities, the diabetes, the hypertension, such and other other conditions that can be well maintained with proper diet, exercise, and the like. So how do you really see that telemedicine? Like, how would you think a scenario might be able to play out to help us all so that we don't have to have all these illnesses in the future, these chronic diseases?
I think more than telemedicine, it would be a population education. And like I know, I was bugging most of my colleagues just to take a simple vitamin D. It's good for you. It promotes your immune system. It protects you against the infections, the influenza. But somehow I see it's hard to sell because people don't believe that. And I think with what's happening right now, a better education for the populations, the telemedicine that can be more available to more people at a cheaper price, and also access to healthcare, to preventive healthcare, instead of going and, for example, sitting in an emergency room. There's app now, you can see a doctor and have a primary consultation. That would help a lot to prevent the chronic diseases.
Right, and also, doctor, in terms of perhaps some healthcare disparity throughout our country, it might also open up the ability for folks to have a telemedicine consult with a doctor and open up better health care for those folks. So Doc, you know, we're spending some time talking about your personal experience. You know, are these the telemedicine industry and how you see the future of it? Do you think that that's another mechanism to bring better health for folks, where employers, you know, can get more involved and focus on wellness for their employees? Do you think there may be a push for that?
I don't know if the telemedicine can help to change people's lifestyle, but it can really help to monitor them. But what is mostly in the people's hands, I think, and that comes with education. Like, put the good food in your mouth, go exercise. Doesn't make sense. And then the telemedicine can monitor and have access to better care with a better way to promote that type of changes.
Yeah, you know what's really fascinating? I just wanted to talk because telemedicine's on everybody's mind now, and just the way they're interacting with their healthcare professionals. The question was, in my mind, you know, growing up, there were times where the doctor would actually come to your house. The doctors made house calls. And I'm thinking more about, like, telemedicine. It's kind of nice. You know, you don't have to go to the doctor's office. For a lot of people, they're afraid to, you know, have an illness if they go to the doctor's office, so they can get, treated at their house. Do you think there's a financial benefit, too, for that interaction in terms of the healthcare costs?
The thing that the field of medicine is a hands-on practice, so you still, you know, I still have a couple, I had a few consultation myself in the last month with my doctors, and one of them, I was a new patient, and, you know, I felt that somehow it was missing something, like he didn't take my blood pressure, he didn't listen to my chest, or, you know, he's still a hands-on. I think it should be a combination. We cannot totally change the medicine to just the telemedicine. We need a combination, but that combination, I think we can expose less patients to the waiting room. But in my understanding, we need to have follow-up, physical follow-up with the doctor in any field. But then the follow-up can be done by telemedicine, and also that telemedicine can help to have more accurate and on-time follow-up. Instead of patient being busy at work, stuck in traffic, we can follow up with the patient much easier. And I find out the patient actually may like that better with their with their timing, with their scheduling, or being in their living room and having a consultation, a follow-up consultation with a doctor.
Right. So, you know, and once again, I mean, I know this is an evolving area of medicine with telemedicine and just how patients are interacting now with their healthcare delivery systems. I realize that, you know, obviously the hands-on approach, you still need that. But on the other hand, like you just touched on, the follow-ups, do you envision perhaps where patients could have their own oxygen saturation? You know, you put your finger in that little thing and it gives you the oxygen saturation, maybe sensors, other ways like streaming real-time data, to really make it almost like you're in the doctor's office. Not that you're there, but you get a lot more data. Do you maybe see that coming down the road?
It's already there. We already have apps that record your heart rate, your pacemaker. There's also some device you can connect to your phone that you can put your finger on, and you get your O2 saturations. Absolutely, the technology is here, and there's only one way. It will grow. It will grow, definitely.
Right, and then that obviously gives a lot more people access to great doctors like you without having to physically go to your, let's say, your office or the hospital, and would also bring down diseases because people are monitoring their condition, you know, or they're just to really avoid any chronic issues. I mean, we all want to stay healthy, certainly. So, Doc, do you have any other, you know, advice for the listeners today in terms of just, you know, you're on the healthcare side of it. You know, you're there when, God forbid, somebody's sick enough, they need to go to the hospital. Any other advice before we conclude this very informative show?
Yes, absolutely. We are getting back to a new normal. The country is opening up, and we need to get back to our life. I mean, that's critical. We cannot go on, like, staying quarantined forever. And if we do that, it will be another pandemic, which will be an emotional and mental pandemic. And, you know, people have to be aware the virus is here and we stay there for a long time. And we just need to have start new habits, you know, be aware of our social distancing, wear mask the right way, clean our hands, do not touch our mouth or ears or eyes, but at the same time, you know, continue with our life and go back to work and socialize again. You know, we are a species that we live in community. We cannot be isolated. It's not mentally good for us. And again, like we mentioned, stay healthy, exercise, boost your immune system, and that's the best prevention that you can have. And just go on with your life. But don't be afraid of what's out there, because this virus is there, and we just need to learn how to fight it and to go around it.
Right. Well, Doctor, I want to say thank you again so much for you and all the heroic doctors and nurses, the healthcare staff that are providing incredible medical service, care, and compassion during these times. I know the curve is flattening. I know we're getting back to some of being out and about, but I still think social distancing is vitally important. But God bless you. Please send my best to all of the incredible heroes. So I wanted just to conclude the show with just saying, you know, we all once again have to be so thankful for doctors like Dr. Sitari and the local hospitals and everybody making a difference in everybody's life. Next week, we're going to go into the world of sports. We're going to bring on Marty Lyons, an incredible Jet, one of the greatest Jets of all time. And we're going to explore with him his humanity. Not only was he an incredible football player, but he's given so much back to society, launching the Marty Lyons Foundation. So next week, I really hope you tune in. It's going to be a very exciting show for me, and I'm a big football fan, so I think it'll be fun talking a little football, but more importantly, about his huge heart and what he's doing to make the world better. So remember, everyone, we're in this together. God bless you. Enjoy this beautiful weekend, and I really hope you tune in next week and take care of each other. God bless.